You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This interview was recorded during the Melbourne International Comedy Festival whilst I was on tour with Jimmy McGee and the wonderful Tom Allen. We've started together years ago.
Yes,
In the famous 2005 Millikan Bridges Alan Wilkinson
Stuart
Goldsmith
and Josh Thomas.
Oh, there's Josh Thomas, of course. Jesus. So I've seen you develop all over the place. I've seen your work fairly regularly.
Yeah.
This is none of it. This is always a problem. Okay, scrap all that.
The
problem I have is that whenever I do it with people who I know well, I never know where to start. I just kind of go, blah, blah, blah.
Don't worry. So you've known me for a long time. I was just enjoying that. I was just bathing in that feeling of like, yes, Stuart, what else? What else?
Let's start with your persona on stage.
Okay.
Because that, and we can root that in when we all started together, when we were all in those competitions together in 2005.
Yeah.
And something I was going to do but I didn't get a chance to do was to listen back to the BBC New Talent.
Oh, right.
Thing
yeah,
that we were
yeah,
in
yeah,
2004
yeah.
or 5.
Yeah.
Me and Jimmy were in the same one as you.
Right, yeah.
And I'd got the recording on my phone.
Oh.
And we were listening to it in Adelaide going, oh, yeah, do you remember that? And he was kind of going, oh, shamefaced as he put the boot into the judges, memorably.
Oh, Jimmy did?
Yeah, Jimmy did.
Yes, I remember that, yeah.
I'll play it to you later on.
I didn't do that, did I?
No, you didn't.
I don't remember that.
But yeah. I remember you coming to comedy with your persona pretty much fully formed.
Yeah. Yeah,
because I don't see much of a like. There's I think your jokes are better. You're far more confident, and you've got a lot more sort of angles and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of your persona, is it? And I'm aware that your persona on stage is not 100 miles away from how you deal with everyday life.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Is that good?
I think,
is that positive?
Yeah, I think that I've always been quite aware of sort of having a take on things, maybe, or a personality type that is quite specific.
Yeah.
And I think I felt like I've become more confident with that as I've got a bit older, I suppose.
Sure.
There's so much to do with age, I think, as well, in comedy. Like, the older you are, the more... Just the more life experience you have and the more content you feel to go, yeah, I'm allowed to be here. I'm not so scared of it.
Yeah, when you talk about being at school, you've been talking a lot about school in your latest stuff. I have a vision of you, the fully formed Tom Allen that I see on stage with the blazer and the brooch and the pocket square, of that kid walking around school.
Yes.
Was it like that? How were you in school?
A bit like that. I mean, at first that was very difficult because, and I think I reference it a bit, in that I think other kids can be very cruel and very, I don't know if it's like a human instinct thing, but if somebody's different or outside of the pack, the instinct is to distrust that. And I don't know quite what made me so different. I think when I was a very young kid, I've always sort of had a feeling of being different. And I don't know if that's to do with being gay or not, but I guess that probably adds to it as well, that you sort of feel different in some way and you're not quite sure what it is. And so, and it takes you a while to figure out what that actually means. But I certainly always felt different. I don't know if it was a way of me maybe demonstrating that I, of how I felt, that I would dress strangely.
Okay. So how did you arrive upon comedy?
Because I always liked performing, and I always liked being an actor, and I did like plays and things at school, and I had some great teachers who were very encouraging to me, and I think I found that very frustrating, because actually I knew that I had a stance on things. Mm. To be an actor, you sort of like, they're like, well, we need someone to do this thing in our thing.
Sure.
And so you have to be on their terms, but as a comedian, you're on your own terms, essentially.
Yes.
And I think as I got older, I realised that I did actually really love stand-up, and I really loved comedy. But I always loved, I always loved, like, obscure people. I never loved, like, Bill Hicks, for example. I'd never listened to Bill Hicks as a kid or something.
Okay.
I'd always listen to, like, Victoria Wood, or I'd listen to Frankie Howard or Kenneth Williams or someone like that, who had a stand-up raconteur-y skill.
Yes.
That wasn't, you know, isn't really recognised in clubs, which are often very machismo places. The comedy scene, I think, can often be a very macho place.
Sure.
And I was always interested in people who just had something peculiar to say.
Yes.
Because I guess I related to that.
Yes, okay. Yeah, one of the notes I made while I was watching the other night was the structure of your work is very much a story. Even though it isn't an A to B story, nor is it really, hey, here's what I think about this. There is a lot of attitude in it, there's a lot of opinion in it, but it's couched in So the Other Day.
Right, yeah, I really like that. I think I am honest as well about something. I try and tell a story as honestly as I can without sort of reframing it and going, oh well, you know, and then everybody's head exploded.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I try and tell it as realistically as possible, because I think audiences do like that, and they do. The audiences do trust that and actually feel more invested in it if it is peculiar but real. I like the idea of people talking to each other. I've always liked talking, and I've always liked interacting with people, and I think that maybe comes from feeling quite lonely as a child a lot of the time.
Okay.
And feeling quite isolated.
Do you think those feelings reflect the truth of your situation? Were you lonely and isolated, or was that something you did to yourself, or was it?
Maybe I did to myself, but I did find it very difficult to jump in and be kind of like surrounded by friends at times.
Sure.
And so I think I always liked the idea of peculiar people who were either dead or were on the television,
yes,
being eccentric, and I liked hearing their stories about their world. I think
sort of empowering somehow.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, look, it's not weird to be a bit weird.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
okay.
There's a strange validation in it. And I think that's what I find with comedy now that I like, is that someone like Maria Bamford talking about sort of kind of going, sort of talking about feeling lonely or feeling peculiar, strange, or having weird kind of fantasies or childish instincts, is really powerful. Because it's not joke format, it's not this and then this. It's actually somebody's experience of life. And I think
it's like an outpouring of someone's soul, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think there are theories, aren't there, about what actually makes people laugh. And I think that my favourite one is that it's about someone going, I feel a thing, and then the other people laughing, because they want to sort of reach out and go, yes, I feel that too.
Yes, sure, okay.
And it's kind of a human instinct thing to do with the pack, that you're like, yes, I'm with you on that. We're still in the same boat. We're still in the same pack. We're still in a community, which I think is the big human thing. Is that that's why human beings are the most powerful animals on the planet, is because they can form communities and, you know, relate to each other.
Sure. And just going back to the childhood thing, you've got that lovely line in your show at the moment, which is that, you know, I didn't get on with other kids at school because I told them all that I was an emperor. and that's lovely, because there's something about your persona on stage that is, and I think I've maybe said this to other guests on the show before, it's not that it's cartoonish. I don't mean that it's broad,
sure,
but it's a little bit like we're watching you thinking, what's he going to do next? You know, it's like this strip of, it's like almost like I said this before, I think about Mickey Flanagan. I feel like it's a comic strip where we see him walking along and it's like, what am I going to get up to next? Do you know what I mean? When you talk about telling the kids at school you're an emperor, I can absolutely see you in sort of a gold turban as like an 8-year-old going, imagining people to do your bidding.
Yes.
I don't know why that's so. why that's such a rich image. I think maybe it's that you're, that what you're articulating on stage has a lot of truth in it.
Yeah.
We get, when you say I'm different, we get you, we believe that you're different.
Well, yeah, and I think that was, it was such a weird thing that I sort of, when I thought of that line, thought, like, this isn't part, like, this doesn't fit any concept of what a stand-up should be saying on stage in terms of jokes.
Sure.
It's just a thing, and I said it because I do remember being fascinated with, like, high-status people.
Yes,
I was fascinated by the film Flash Gordon and Emperor Ming and kind of, yeah, and people. I think that's, again, to do with wanting to feel in control when you're not quite sure of yourself or you feel insecure as a young person.
Yes.
You like high-status people because I don't know, they have control over their environment.
Okay.
A bit like, I suppose that's why I really enjoyed watching Carry On films as well, because Kenneth Williams always plays high-status.
Yes.
You know, he's always, like, he's always the head doctor at the hospital.
Yes, I see. Okay.
I'm probably rambling here and not making any sense.
No, that does.
Sorry, go on.
No, I think that does make sense, because I get that kind of the empowerment of being a high status person, but there's also something you play with status on stage, or what mm-hmm. you do on stage ends up playing with status, because I think audiences feel a tremendous love for you, and we don't see you as being a sort of in a traditionally high status kind of leader role, but then you do occupy this kind of other thing where people want to cuddle you, I think. You know, I certainly want to cuddle you on stage. It's like you're high status, but you're also like our child that we want to preserve and look after.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's what I do. I do it to try and secure my own protection if there was a nuclear war. I think, well, that's nice of you to say. I feel like that you were very encouraging to me, actually, on this trip. You and Jimmy have been great friends to me on this trip, but also in the past as well, in terms of going... Of going, no, people do get that, because my instinct is always to go, if I say something weird, no one's going to understand that, or if I wear a brooch, people are going to hate me.
Sure.
And actually both you guys have been very good at going, no, we like that, people like that,
yeah,
go with it, take it to the next, take it as far as you want to take it.
Sure.
And you said to me the other day, which I was very pleased about, that I always worry that when I walk out there, people go, the audience goes, oh, he's a prick, I hate him.
Yeah.
And so my instinct's always been that I have to, like, do something very early on that's like, I'm stupid, I'm just like you, I'm stupid.
Okay.
You know, I'm just like you, but I'm worse than you. And then they'll be like, yeah, we're better than him, so we can now watch him. But actually, you've sort of gone, like, no, people get who you are as a person, and they trust you and they like you. So that's very empowering, I think, because you do want to feel like, as a performer and as a writer, ultimately, you want to feel like you can talk about whatever you want, and you need to feel confident and empowered to do that. And I think, like, I had a conversation with the American comedian Eugene Merman, and he said, like, all any comedian can do is just tell audiences how they see the world from their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really nice, simple way of putting it, is that, like, you have to be specific about it. You have to show that it's your view of the world.
Mm.
You have to be brave about that.
That's a good point, actually. There's a lot of quite non-specific comedy, isn't there?
I
suppose that's what gets up people's noses, reviewers and so forth, when, you know, there are certain reviewers who, in the UK, for example, mm-hmm. who people might go, oh, God, they're only ever satisfied when something's really kind of weird and edgy and difficult. I suppose it's because there's an awful lot of non-specific or sort of generic observation.
Yeah, which I always find can be... fun as well, but I really love it when somebody goes, you know, like, oh, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example of something that somebody else would do, but like, yeah, I cry in supermarkets or something, you know, like something weird is actually really beautiful,
because
it's brave, because it's a really brave thing to do, to go, actually, I've got this thing, I've got this problem, I've got this worry that's just mine, and I'm embarrassed to tell anybody, and I'm going to keep it to myself, because otherwise if I tell people they might push me out of the group, might not, you know, find a boyfriend, a girlfriend, whatever.
Sure.
But when somebody goes, sometimes I punch myself in the face just to feel alive, you go, oh my God, that's so, like, brave.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes, we really appreciate the risk
exactly. And I think that's why I am very grateful to you guys and for that encouragement. And I think it's so important that comedians especially identify as artists who are entitled to support, because I think often it can feel very combative, yeah. A lot, some comedy environments and some sort of tones, and I think that's why I get very, very angry at the idea of excuse me, anybody in the industry, whatever that means,
yeah.
Or anybody in the media who slates somebody's, you know, who tries to demean somebody or tries to undermine somebody's
yeah.
confidence creatively, or shame them and kind of go, that wasn't funny, why did you do that?
Yeah.
You know, I dare say a lot of people have had experience of that. And I get very angry about that the older I get, because I think it's so important to nurture and nourish and really care for anybody who's putting themselves out there.
Yes.
Because it is a brave thing. And if you smash someone in the face, they won't do it again, you know, like they won't have the confidence then to try anything else. They'll just go into their they'll go into a safe space which will be generic.
Yes.
And you know, yeah, so I think I've just done the Artist's Way.
Yes, you mentioned this before, tell us about that.
Well, it's, I think a lot of people are doing it at the moment, and my friend Eleanor Tom, who is a very dear friend of mine and a great inspiration, recommended that I do it, because I was feeling very blocked in terms mm-hmm. of writing, and she suggested doing it. And basically the tenets of it largely are: get up every day and write 3 pages of stream of consciousness writing.
Gotcha.
Don't censor yourself, don't you can write complaints about yourself, you can slander yourself, whatever you want, and it does 2 things. It parks all of that negativity or all those worries and thoughts mm-hmm. in one place, so you can get on with the day. But it also means that you've already done 3 pages of writing before you've done yeah. anything else. And I think the antidote to any inertia, is that the mm-hmm. right word, when you don't do anything, or any sort of feeling of being blocked, or any depression, is largely action, isn't it? It's largely like, take the first step, put the key
yes.
in the door. You know, just the smallest step towards doing something is usually what takes people out of it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, it talks about building a relationship with yourself, and it talks about respecting your creativity. And it's, I mean, I suppose a lot of people will go like, oh, what a load of crap. But I think, again, a lot of people feel very scared of the idea of going, well, I'm a human being
yes.
as well as a performer or a comedian.
Yes.
And I'm entitled to feel protective of that. Like, a shopkeeper is allowed to put shutters on his shop.
Yes.
Or her shop, because they're protecting their product, and as creative people, we should feel the same.
I like the idea of being entitled to support. That's not anything I've heard anyone say on the show before,
oh, right.
but I think that's a really good point. I think... what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, like you said, if you smash someone in the face, they won't do it again. Like, I wonder how many of the people that might be derided now by younger acts as being commercial club
right.
hacks, for want of a better word,
right.
or maybe not hacks, but, you know, those kind of powerhouse,
sure.
you know, jonglers or highlight closers of
yeah.
10 years ago, say,
yeah.
who maybe now don't seem to be sort of... exciting comics,
right? Yeah.
I wonder whether that was because, or in part because, they weren't supported, and it is a macho, almost a very violent in that, in inverted
yeah,
commas,
absolutely.
Environment
yeah,
to have to go out and win every night,
yeah,
with
yeah.
no support, with no one saying it's okay not to win, because in those environments it isn't okay not to win, you have to win,
yeah, yeah,
or,
yeah.
or we think that you do that, you know, well, I guess yeah. you do to get paid, to get rebooked.
Yeah.
So I wonder how much, to what extent that type of comedy is a result of not having a caring enough support network.
I imagine very much so, yeah.
Mm.
And I think that, of course, it's difficult, and I think it's difficult to... It's scary to sort of go, no, I want to do something different, and people go, well, what is it? And you go, well, I don't know. That's hard.
Mm.
But that is what I think is what's necessary sometimes. But... our society generally isn't very good with failure, and isn't very good with trying stuff out or the grey area in between. So if something's not a definite thing,
yes,
I think society generally is a bit like, we don't like it, then it's not, it's rubbish, it's broken, I hate it.
Sure.
And I think that often, yeah, and I think that audiences in certain environments can be very scary. And I think as well, audiences sometimes react very strongly if they don't like a comedian, or if they feel like they're worried about a comedian, actually.
Mm.
I think that happens a lot, is that if you get up there and the audience goes, oh, I'm worried about this person, that can be a really sort of unexpected, strange, difficult yes. in comedy.
It only takes the slightest little nudge to get in the way of that incredibly... the two plates over which the spark of a joke has to leap.
Yeah,
to make it work. It only takes just a tiny little shift to make that... That alchemy can't happen. That reaction can't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if the person is scared or is showing that they're scared...
Mm.
I wonder, I don't know, but about the comedians from 10 years ago and that environment. But I think that for me, like, the best comedy environments are the ones that celebrate all the details and the quirks and, you know, and I think we've had experiences of that in Melbourne. Melbourne audiences have been very welcoming to us. And
yes. kind
of those days when I suppose there seems to be a big crowd of energetic people who love even the smallest little detail. They sort of treasure
that. Yes, that's true, actually, yeah.
But that, I think, you know, that requires, I don't know, a certain mentality maybe. And maybe some audience people, audience members, find that very difficult to kind of celebrate something that they find great and prefer to go with the generic because it feels safer.
How much do I love Tom Allen? He's amazing. He's such a good comedian. He's such a good, kind, supportive man. He's got a razor-sharp wit, and if you haven't seen him, you absolutely must. We didn't really have time to talk about Bleak Expectations, which is a radio series that Tom is in, and he's done so many other bits of work as well, particularly, I mean, as you can tell from his amazingly rich voice, he's much in demand in the world of radio, so you can track down lots and lots of different bits and bobs that Tom has done. We focus here, as ever, mostly on his stand-up, and I think this is... I think I mentioned in this show that some of my favourite moments of the tour that I've recently completed with Tom and Jimmy were just little moments in the corridor before going on stage. Just little moments where I'd have come off, Tom had come off, and we'd be waiting to go back on for the uniquely exciting curtain call that one does on the Mary Tobin Presents gigs, which is quite a fabulous thing. But Tom would just be so giving, so generous with his time, and really brave in his critique of my work, of his own work, and they just made for some really fascinating conversations. I think we've really got the spirit of those conversations here. So that's all I'll say about this. I'll let it speak for itself, as usual. Other than to say, if you haven't seen Tom Allen, you really, really must. There are some moments, actually, in this interview that in the editing, I went back and took out me endlessly quoting his material. I left a few in as well, but I thought that's not the purpose of this podcast, is to quote loads of Tom's material. But I found it difficult to talk to him without going, oh, and there's that amazing bit where you say this, or that wonderful bit where you say that. So there we go. This is the fabulous Tom Allen. In other news, I'm afraid I've now fixed a broken link that was on the site, that was on the Facebook page and consequently the website. So you can now find at comedianscomedian.com in the lower central box there. There's a link to the Facebook page for the podcast, which now has the link for the Benny Boot podcast, the live show on 29th of May, Wednesday the 29th of May, shortly after I get back from the final leg of my Antipodean tour. And so tickets now available for that. Plenty of tickets left. I thought they were selling fast, and then I realised the link was broken, so I'd misinformed myself. But you must come along and see Benny Boot. I think that one is going to be a really, really entertaining night. So apologies to all those of you who emailed me and said that you couldn't get tickets. The link is now up there and fully functional. Anything else to say? I've had some emails. I've had some great emails, some tweets and stuff, and I suppose I keep promising to read some of them out. And I very rarely get round to doing that. I've had some great ones. I try and respond to them all. Anyway, I'm super busy. I'm here in New Zealand on a tour of the North Island with some fabulous British comedians, as well as Tom Gleeson, an Australian actor who I didn't get a chance to see or interview when I was in Australia. Hopefully, he's agreed to be on the show, so hopefully we'll get that to you soon. A couple more absolute doozies already in the can that will be coming up in the next few weeks. So I hope you look forward to them. info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to get in contact with me, or you can tweet me at ComComPod. Let's get back to the wonderful Mr. Tom Allen.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So when you walk out on stage looking and sounding as you do, mm-hmm. are you saying that you're, that there's some part of you, I think you said earlier, that there's some part of you wants to what? Not necessarily to be the high status, but to prove that you can be stupid, almost to be a low status person so that they know you're
daft? I think it was
daft.
For a long time. It was for a okay. time. But then in the last, I would say probably in the last 6 months, I felt like I am more, I feel more strongly that I'm like, oh no, well, the right people will get it, will like me and listen to me. And I don't have to. I think for a long time I felt like I had to apologize. I think that's what I was trying to say.
Sure.
That I felt like I had to say, I'm sorry I'm here, but let's just make the best of it.
Why would you need to apologize?
Because I'd be wasting their time, or because I'd be sort of confusing them, or I'm sort of too different and kind of weird, and they'll be like, why are you doing this? Why aren't you telling us jokes?
Okay.
Those sort of insecurities.
Okay. But, I mean, you recognise that you have got loads of jokes.
Yes, now I do.
Sure.
And now I recognise that...
I mean, you always did. You always did. When you used to... I mean, the earliest joke of yours I remember was... the thing about, about your parents talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing was... I can't remember which way around it was. It was like, oh, don't go out, Clothies, you know, then that was just my dad. Or, you know.
Yeah.
So that was, I mean, you had sort of proper jokes from an early age in your comedy career.
I suppose so. I think it's, I think it's taken me a time to kind of realise what are jokes as well. That sounds
sure.
weird.
Okay.
But I always thought like of funny things or quirks and details and sort of stuff. But people always say, you've got to write more jokes, you've got to have jokes.
Yes.
You know, not necessarily to me, but generally.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I was like, well, I don't, what do you mean jokes? Like, knock-knock jokes or something? And then I realised, like, jokes are just something that's just funny, just a thing. Anything
yes.
that's funny.
Anything
amazing,
that generates a laugh.
Is basically
nine times
a joke.
Out of ten.
Yeah,
joke.
Yeah,
yeah,
joke.
Yeah, sure.
And once I realised that, I felt... like, oh, okay, I can do that, yeah.
Yeah, because you absolutely can. You've got so many little... almost like kind of flourishes in your work. There's in between the stories and the setups and the punchlines, you've got loads of when you put your foot up on the speaker stack, up on the monitor,
oh, yeah.
and try it out and then go, oh, this doesn't suit me at all,
which of course I do spontaneously.
Yeah. But those things seem to me to come from a very secure place.
Oh.
That you have, that you know, you radiate the confidence that you could just, I'll try, you know, you, it's almost like you can try something out because you know that you can then go, oh, I wasn't very good at that. Like you were talking to the audience last night and the night before, and you said, well, this is the end of the audience interaction bit, which I know I've heard that line before, that you chat to them.
Yes.
However, I mean, it often goes very well.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh, that's the end of the audience interaction bit. I'm shit at it. It's ghastly, isn't it? And move on. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's almost like you give yourself this safety net whereby you can be brilliant at something, or it can, you know, you can take a risk, like putting your foot on the monitor or whatever, because
yeah.
you know that you can come back to a place of going, oh, well, that wasn't very good.
Well,
and there's something about the way you criticise yourself that's really warm and funny as well.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, I started doing the audience interaction line of saying that I hate audience interaction. Sort of doing it to the extent about a week ago.
Mm.
And I think it's one of those things that it's just, I think it's a nice thing because maybe it plays with the idea of like, this facade is not real. Like this,
yes.
whole
definitely.
Environment that we're all in
yeah.
is not real. And that like, I can talked, you know, and that everything is breakable. Everything is
sure,
you know. And I think audiences maybe like that idea of like, oh, it doesn't have to be like, you know, like,
yes,
like,
yes.
I mean, I'm saying that like I calculated it in some intellectual manner.
Sure.
I didn't. I just went, oh, I'll just say that now.
Yeah,
because it's sort of true.
Yeah.
And
but then there's definitely, I think there's something that's the choices we make are guiding all of us, aren't they? So you could, you know, even though you didn't calculate that, you recognised the pleasure in that thing that you're articulating now.
Yeah.
And would attempt to repeat it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I think just playing with things like that is just interesting. I think I did it in my first set, actually, where I told quite a long story and then it built and then it concluded, and then I sort of then said, well, anyway, that's one story. I hope you liked it. Basically, I went to work in a restaurant. I didn't like it, so I left.
I remember that. I loved it.
And it was a long, like, it was like a 5-minute story, and then it ended at the end. And I just kind of like that idea of going,
it's wonderful.
Like, that was really important to me, but nothing matters.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of our job, because you talk a lot about clowning, and I wish I knew, or clowns. Clown? Clowning?
Yes.
Clown.
Yeah, but either.
Clown. And I wish I knew more about it, but that idea of kind of going, that's sort of our job traditionally, I suppose, is to go like, it's all nonsense, everything
you
do.
Yes, yes.
It's like, I'll hold it up as a big important thing, and then I'll smash it on the floor as nothing.
Absolutely, and I think that gets lost a lot of the time in comedy, because people are so, you know, comics are so kind of, here's my thing, here are my jokes.
Yeah.
And it's almost like that then becomes the, I don't mean like mainstream in the sense of alternative mainstream, but the thing which is presented has to be presented spotlessly and well.
Yes.
You know, these are the jokes. This is the humorous monologue. This is my selection of really fast punchlines.
Yes.
And then actually what that line does that you're talking about is to then hold the whole thing up and go, God, aren't we all cocks? Do you know what I mean? Isn't this
yeah,
all...
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah.
To go, well, just, I suppose I find it difficult to take myself seriously a bit and go, you know, it's a weird thing, isn't it, to kind of stand up in front of people and go, oh, you should listen to me. You should listen to what I've got to say. It'll be interesting.
Yes.
My instinct is...
But it's really good that you keep a live kind of awareness of that, because I think it's very easy for a lot of comics to go, this, you know, this is the thing. This is the performance.
Yeah.
And you have to pay attention to it. Like, I saw someone fairly recently, within the last 3 or 4 months, do some material about... it's kind of quasi-political material about religion and homophobia, and inherent homophobia of religion. And someone in the audience shouted out, what about the Westboro Baptist Church? Like, in an encouraging kind of a way.
Oh, right.
Like, you know, that,
yeah.
And the performer said, I don't care about them. And you sort of went, oh, right. You know, this isn't... What is going on here then? Are you just kind of tagging these words to get your joke across?
Oh,
it didn't
seem
like it was kind of breathing
that's
in that way.
Something that I have to remind myself is that I feel like good comedy is, you know, and that's always the thing, isn't it, that we're trying to discover, like, what makes something good and what makes something less good. And what I'm realizing more and more is that good comes from just basically talking about something that you genuinely feel is important or interesting or feel an emotion to, like, feel an emotion with. It connects with you on some sort of level. And what I aspire to do is to be able to sort of go, well, I feel this, and to talk about it and kind of embellish it then with jokes and embellish it with kind of, you know, taking it on sort of weird tangents and spirals in your mind. That's when it's more amusing, but it should always have a feeling of like, well, I really care about this thing that I'm talking about. I mean, maybe that's what came unstuck, but with the guy you described.
Sure.
But, I think it should, it has to connect with you. And that's why, for example, someone like Louis C.K., it does feel like he really does feel those feelings.
Yes.
And does, you know, feel angry about the way that people sort of, like, in the West, don't communicate properly. Our language has lost its form, and he talks about how energetic a lot of Middle Eastern languages are, and you kind of go, yeah, that's probably, that's, that feels like a really real experience. And when he talks, you know, about, like, kind of having, again, that inertia of sitting around in his hotel room, and how that, you know, it feels like it's something really important to him, and so it has to be based in something to make sense. You can't, I don't think it's enough just to go, oh, a thing.
Yes.
Like, you have to care about the thing.
Sure. you are piercingly honest, I think, in your observation stuff when you say, for example, you know, I thought this would be a perfect opportunity for people to think well of me. You know, or you go, like I mentioned before, that line about judging people because I know how frequently I am judged.
Yeah.
So is that honesty painful? Is that honesty difficult to say on stage?
Well, I think it's the thing I have to, like, remind myself of, like, because all our instincts are to go, no, hide that thing that's true about you, make yourself presentable. But actually, I have to go, no, I do remember pretending that I was an emperor as a child, and that feels weird, but it gets a response when I'm on stage, I think, because it's honest, and it's not, and it's just, it's surprising, because it's not what I don't think anybody would expect a child to say. You know, if we're deconstructing that silly line. That's the thing of, like, to push sort of deeper into one's self is is what I think maybe makes or might make me a better writer, is if I keep my eye on the really sort of personal, honest stuff. And I think never shying away from that is probably what I need to keep aiming to do more of.
Let's talk about the writing for a bit. Let's kind of home in on the writing, because you have some real diamond lines. Like, the one that I was describing you to people in Adelaide before you came out was, oh, his opening line used to be, I don't know about you, well, how could I? And that's such a beautiful line. It's such a perfect and perfectly silly line. And there's another one that you said, you just popped in the other day, about, like, going to high school, which is where you take drugs.
Yes.
Or judging. Oh, I know. I'm worried about being judged because I know that I spend a lot of time judging other people.
Yes.
Myself, you know.
Yes.
And so those lines like that, are those lines that you sat down and wrote, or are they things that tumbled out on stage because you were in the right gear?
I would say they, yeah, sort of tumbled out on stage. Sometimes I didn't even notice them. To be honest, the thing about, like, I don't know about you, and how could I, just came out by something I just said once.
Sure.
And it got a response. And again, I think it takes such nurturing, but, like, you saying, like, that's a really good line,
yeah,
really helped me to go, oh, that's, I should have more confidence in that line.
Sure.
And suddenly that becomes a joke, whatever that
means.
Yes,
okay. Yeah,
Whereas actually it was just me saying something. But and with the stuff I'm doing at the moment, I found that I would do a lot of stream of consciousness talking, often in front of a friend or my mum or like people, and that really, in terms of feeling blocked,
is that something you're doing at the moment?
Yeah.
Okay, tell me about that. That's fascinating.
And just sort of just kind of sitting down with somebody and them going, yeah, that's just, I'll just listen, it'll be fine.
Wonderful. Who is this person? Are they another comic or a...
My friend Eleanor.
Okay. Eleanor, okay.
And then also I've sort of found myself reaching out to other comedians as well, people like Susie Ruffle, who's a really good friend of mine, and Mae Martin, who's a and who are lovely people, and we sort of do that a bit for each other and sort of go, hey, it's okay, like, to not be funny. Like, you don't have to prove that you're funny all the time.
Yes.
Just talk about something and see if there's some funny bits in it.
That sounds like a really fun and sociable way to create material.
It's really easy to get into your own head and to get very lonely.
Yes.
Because you stand on stage on your own, and then people say, like, well, are you writing new material? And I think the difficulty is that, like, I find I can't sit down and, like, at a typewriter and go,
sure,
and then I did this and then I did
that. Yes, okay.
But I can kind of go, oh, I'll talk about my alarm clock and why I hate it.
Okay. With no pressure to be funny. You're just,
I'm just talking.
That is fascinating.
And
brilliant.
Going, like, and not having any censorship and going, well, I don't know where I'll go. And feeling that permission of kind of going, we can talk about whatever we like and there's no rules and it doesn't have to be a certain way. And as my friend Eleanor said to me, we were talking about Eddie Izzard and how great he is at sort of taking risks and messing up,
yeah,
and acknowledging it and being silly.
Mm-hmm.
What would we'd say to a child, don't be silly, he embodies, and she described watching him as, like, it's like you've danced in his head for an hour. It's just like you've been on a... You've just danced in his thoughts for, like, an hour when you watch it. And I think that is kind of, again, a good comedian just kind of allows you to just come in and go, oh, well, then this happened, and then this happened. And it's a real... Yeah, and we forget it because, again, it's really difficult to fail, I think. We have this huge pressure, and if you... You know, the times I tried to sit down and write... I've been horrible.
Yes, God, they always are. I hate it.
And I think no one wants to acknowledge it.
I love it. I don't want to do any. I hate sitting down and writing.
Yeah,
I hate it. I hate forcing myself. I think that was it. I think some people do enjoy that.
Right.
But I know that for me, it's always something I make myself do. Okay. And as a result, I spend a lot of time prevaricating, which is painful and anxious, anxiety
inducing.
Yeah,
of course, yeah.
And or doing it badly.
Yeah.
Where I'm kind of doing it, but I'm sort of not really enjoying it. And it takes an awful lot of that time to come up with one little slot where I'm actually doing it and flowing and enjoying it.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the way we naturally converse as humans, but loads of people are really funny when they're chatting to their friends because there's a human there that you're trying to make them laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
So why would you ever sit down with a flat, blank computer that you can't make laugh?
Yeah, yeah.
And do
and
that.
Just your sort of judgments and inner workings. And my mum, for example, is the person who has always encouraged me from like a very young age to watch comedy, and I think has one of the most refined sense of humours I've ever been aware of. And so she's... Yeah, so I really trust her instinct. I mean, she doesn't work in comedy, she doesn't write herself.
Sure.
But I really trust her instincts, and so... kind of going around there and sort of talking about sitting in my mum's lounge and talking about chairs and talking about furniture and talking about it's an occasional chair.
Yes.
And then sort of developing a thing about that out of just talking was just kind of you're just going to get an instant response, and that's our natural gauge. But as well, my mantra has become a bit more like just keep talking as well. Mm-hmm. Like, don't stop talking, just always keep talking and never beat yourself up for getting it wrong. People don't have a right.
Is this within the exercise?
Yeah, and also a bit, and also in, like, not always on stage.
Sure.
But,
just keep talking.
Keep talking all the time. But, you know, if you're doing new material or you're doing, like Mark at the Top Secret Comedy Club.
Yes.
Has been great at just sort of being really encouraging and going, and I turn up and go, I'm feeling like I just want to get on stage on this new material night and just talk about something I don't know about. Like, and I haven't prepared it. Is that okay?
Yes.
And you go, yeah, I'd love you to do that. It'd be really exciting.
Sure.
And I have to force myself to go, it doesn't matter if people don't love this.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't always have to fly, especially if you're writing new things or you're trying something new.
Sure.
People should never be allowed to make you feel bad for trying something.
Yes.
Like, I've sort of had to tell myself, like, the only thing that's bad is I'm always worried about boring people.
Yeah.
Like, never be boring. People told me, I think, when I was a bit younger.
Okay.
And so I'm always worried about, like, oh God, if I say something that isn't funny, they'll be bored and they'll lose interest and they'll hate me. But actually I go, now, no, they haven't. The only thing that's boring is if you keep repeating the same stuff and you don't take risks.
Yes.
Taking risks, you can never beat yourself up for. And I have to consciously go, like, well, that didn't work. But when I walk off stage, I have to go, it didn't work, but I still took the risk, and that's good, and that's fine, and leave it there. Like, don't ever go, stupid idiot, why did you try that? Why did you say that thing?
Okay.
Or why didn't you prepare better? I should have prepared more.
Oh, like, God, that's all part of the litany I say to myself all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of us do, and I think nobody... Well, people do talk about it, but... Yeah, but we don't talk about it enough. That, like, and actually, the things I really like... I really like it when, like, the comedians I like and the musicians I like, when they make a mistake, I don't go like, oh, idiot, oh, God, forget it. I just go, oh, they make mistakes too. That's nice.
Yeah.
Like, our job is basically talking about the mistakes we've made. So the idea of making a mistake on stage should be okay. And my dad's always said, you can't please all the people all the time. And you can't. Like, you can go crazy trying, but you can't please all the people all the time.
Yeah. Do you... feel, this is going to sound a weird question, do you feel talented?
Yes. In that, I don't want to answer this so that I come off well.
do you see what I'm getting at? We're talking about the things that one can do, you know, structures. It occurs to me, I've not asked anyone this before, because it occurs to me that I spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the processes, and I suppose part of that comes from a desire to find a formula, to find a kind of a way of making any human being be really funny. Because I worry at some level that I need that formula, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But do
Coca-Cola.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But do you feel or do you recognise... Yeah, answer the question, we'll go from there.
So, do I think I'm talented?
Yes.
I have to...
I'm not trying to ambush you and go, oh, Tom thinks he's all talented.
Yeah, what a prick. Yeah. Boring. I think, again, to reference Eddie Izzard, and I think the role models are really, really important.
Yes.
But that's a side issue. But in his film Believe, he talks about the fact you have to believe you can be an astronaut before you can be an astronaut.
Yes.
Like, there's no use going like, oh, maybe I'll try and be an astronaut. I'll be an astronaut.
Sure.
And you have to go, I'll be a stand-up comedian. So I guess the talent is just in the ability to believe, and the talent is about, it's just having the energy to go back to it and to go, I will get better and it'll be okay. That's what the talent is actually there.
Persistence. Tenacity.
I always think that about courage as well. Like, I always think like, well, I imagine courage has a lot to do with just not thinking. So, you know, like, and talent maybe is to do with just...
not giving up.
Sort of believing and really wanting to do it. Maybe that's it, you know. I don't really believe in talent per se, I don't think. I think anybody can be good at something if they work hard enough and if they believe in themselves and believe in what they're doing and take themselves seriously. I think it's hard sometimes to take yourself seriously because often we're discouraged from making mistakes and taking risks in life generally, and often we're discouraged from entering into an environment that's creative to make our living. When you've done A-levels, go to university, become a lawyer. Well, you want to be an actor, why don't you become a barrister? Because of course they have to act.
Yeah. I definitely remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, why don't you become a teacher? They're sort of performers, aren't they? Well, they are, but it's not the same. And I liked how they liked to become a barrister, but it's like, what the hell is a barrister?
Yeah.
Like at my school no one had a parent who was a barrister. That was something that people did in Bridget Jones films.
Yeah.
So going back to talent, I think it's about having that desire to do it.
So in your writing, you how do you select subject matter about which to do the stream of consciousness talking? Do you sort of pick random things, or how do you select material and go, oh, that's really me?
I suppose that's the bit where you sit down. That's the only bit where you sit down and actually write.
Okay.
You just go, oh, I want to talk about ironing boards. And go, oh, there's an ironing board in front of my face. That's why I said that. I think, and then you go, and just sort of something you might mention conversationally, you go, oh, yeah, I've got opinions about pylons. I didn't realise that.
Yes, and I keep thinking, living with Jimmy, every so often he'll say, once a day or every 2 days he'll say something, and I'll go, God, write that down, that's really you.
I wish I had
a little thing following me around, like a little hovering robot that could just go, when you say a thing that you don't even notice that's naturally you, something could just go, oh, by the way, that is really you, write that down.
You are funny.
Yeah.
That is true to your persona.
Yeah. Remember not to worry.
I still like you, Stu.
The talent is in the ability to believe. So sorry, we digress. But finding, how do you find things? A different way of asking the question, what things strike you as being particularly Tom Allen things to talk about? Do you think you have an oeuvre?
An oeuvre. I thought that's an... Isn't that a French word for an egg? That's enough. Oh, Jimmy. Stuart.
Fucking interchangeable.
Yeah, the other one. It's because you just mentioned Jimmy. And...
The other one.
No, I think it's important to talk about whatever you want. That's, again, another thing. Like, that's part of my, like, keep talking. Don't censor it. Like, if you want to talk... If I want to talk about football, I don't know anything about it, but I should still feel like I can.
That's fascinating.
Because...
I censor myself all the time. I could never talk about football. I don't know anything about it. But I could surely talk about the fact I don't know anything about football.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I mean, I'm saying all this stuff, and I'm sure that people listening to this will be like, what a fucking prick. And I'm aware that...
They won't at all.
Thank you. Thank you.
And even if they do, you'll never hear about it.
Unless they tweet it at me. But I'm aware that I am very much, like, trying to understand what I'm doing, and I'm very, I feel very early on in my understanding of what I'm doing, so... I spout a lot of things which I found useful and I'm finding useful at the moment.
Sure.
So
That's exactly what we're after.
I think I'm sounding like, and what you must do in that circumstance is sure. Do this and everything will be okay. I don't have any answers myself, but I'm happy to list
sure.
What
that's
I,
fine. I we're just helpful. After your starting point, your system for doing
fine.
That
but in terms of
I get what you mean, because obviously, I mean, we're very similar in that respect. I think we both worry too much about how we're coming across, yeah. That other people might decide not to like us, and that we would then be lonely.
Of course,
yeah.
Of course, and then we'll be lonely, yeah. more lonely. I would be the correct way of describing it for me. But I think that, I think there's no, I kind of think there's no hack topics actually. There's only a hack way of approaching it.
Sure.
So, I had one of my loudest laughs this festival watching the brilliant Celia Piccola.
Mm-hmm. Friend of the show.
Oh, I bet. I didn't doubt it. And she was doing this thing about this routine about airplanes, being on an airplane. And airplanes have become a very hack.
Yes.
You know, usually the go-to thing is, especially airplane food.
Sure. But like, how often do you actually hear jokes about airline food?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. And also, it's always like, oh, what's with airline food? But actually, I always quite like it.
Yeah.
But that aside, but Celia was doing this stuff about being on an airplane, and I didn't clock it until afterwards. Because I was laughing so much, she was talking about how the cabin crew control the world. I don't want to give away her material, but sure. She was just being so hilarious, and I was laughing so. Like, you know, when you really laugh at something, and just her, she was just being a brilliant person on stage. And I realized after that, that's it, she was doing an airline bit, you know.
Yes.
And so, you know, you could go, well, the airline stuff is done, but it's absolutely not. Like, you can talk about airplanes, but you just have to talk about it from your perspective, and you have to be true to your experience of it and your eccentricities on, you know, to surrounding it. Like, there's no point trying to be generic and go, we all do this, don't we? I hate it when comedians do that, when they're like, we're all like this. And it's like, well, I don't know. You've spoken to all of the world.
It's interesting to see where one should place oneself on that, because I...
Now we're using the word one.
I'm not talking about you or I. I'm talking about one. And I worked with... Lizzie Roper.
On the show
last year. Prick, yeah. She directed that. And she, one of the many brilliant things she did, but she had very strong opinions that I should always be saying, I do this, I did this, this is what happened to me, this is how I see the world.
Oh, good.
Rather than you know when you.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, and I really tried to kind of make that show within those parameters, and that was an interesting kind of thing. I think that's what I normally am inclined to do.
Yeah.
And then, funnily enough, seeing Jimmy, I really am very impressed with the way that Jimmy talks to people about their own lives. Uh-huh. He tells us what we all do. So I just think, let's just take those two kind of ends of it. There's saying, I do this, and there's saying, we all do this. So are you saying that you're much more on that, on the I end of the spectrum? Because I kind of feel like there's some weird thing in the middle whereby in saying, I do this, an audience might go, oh, well, I do that as well.
Yeah, that's
but it's sort of about how it's articulated, about how it's phrased, maybe, that lets people in or not.
I guess it's a stylistic thing, and I think it's about, letting people in. That's the other thing, isn't it? That, people have to be able to relate to it, even if you're talking about yourself, I suppose. I think that... It's still a specific experience when Jimmy talks about it. He's still talking about his experience of somebody on a bus or somebody on a tram or people in the park that he's seen. I don't know about that. Yeah, and I guess I'm saying like, oh, it must always be from oneself. But actually, I know, I go, you know when, like, quite
sure, sure.
And I guess it's as well, like, it's presenting it in a way when you go, you know when, but the audience has the option to go, well, I don't know when, but I'll come along with it. Or, maybe I do. I'll decide in a moment.
Let's talk about a couple of things to do with technique. something that Saskia and I were very fond of and ran away giggling about was what I'm going to call the Tom Allen rhythm. Of
the rhythm technique.
You know, we were talking about specifically your line when you say, I'm not that old. I'm not that old myself, but my God, I have lived. And that's specific. We were saying that to each other for ages. So it's specifically that kind of one, two, three.
Yes.
Like, you do that quite a lot. I'm sure that's not a conscious decision, but let's just talk for a minute about rhythm and how you use rhythm.
I don't know if I'm aware of it or not, really, because, like I say, I try and just talk. That's basically what I'm doing. But I suppose naturally things come out. And I sometimes wonder, because I really liked music when I was at school, and I played the piano, and I did A-level music.
Okay.
I think Victoria Woods said this once about how she often notates her set. And I found that sometimes there are certain ways that are the funniest, like pitch to say a word or the rhythm. So it does become quite melodic at times, but I don't do that all the time. I guess the rhythm thing is about withholding. It's about being playful a lot of the time as well.
Yes.
And going, I will give you the information.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
When I feel like it.
It's very, so it's very musical. That's interesting to hear you're a pianist, because that musicality is a huge part of it, and obviously I think that one of the strongest suits that you had when we all started, and something that really made you stand apart from a lot of other comics, was your voice and the musicality of your voice and the rhythm of your voice and the, you know, I mean, that's the other thing that I would use to describe you in shorthand, is I always, you know, whenever I've described you prior to coming, oh, you're lovely, you've got this wonderful, see, this incredibly velvety voice.
Yeah,
I mean, you're aware of that as a tool. I mean, you seem to be someone that really gets the most out of their voice.
Yes, I do like having my voice. I don't.
But that's, even that, you see, you've got such a range of. You can do, like, you can almost bend a note like a guitarist would bend a note. Yeah, well, listen back to that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I find it very difficult to listen to, you know, voice, unfortunately.
A tremulous kind of, well, you know, to signify that I feel uncomfortable about the question. Do you know what I mean? Like, in a funny way, like, I suppose I do. Like,
you understood everything.
Yes, exactly.
You seen all the tricks.
Well, exactly.
I'm just stupid. I'm just like everybody.
And you've got that stupid, oh, I'm such an idiot kind of thing, like that. It's such a broad palette. It's really, really rich.
Oh, thanks. No, I think, well, maybe that's a bit of a like being interested in theatre thing, perhaps, dare I say. Like, I like the fact that a good storyteller can create the whole world for you and uses their voice, really. That's all they do. I once wrote a fan letter to Alan Bennett, and thinking, when I'd written a play when I was like 19, and of course it was terrible, but it was about two people, and actually I did quite like it, but it was about two people on a train, and I was proud of it, and I'm proud of it now. And I sent it to Alan Bennett, because I've always admired, and I think he's somebody who is somebody who's always inspired me since I was a teenager. Again, one of those people, and his famous quote in the History Boys about good art, doesn't matter when it was written, can feel like a hand reaching out across the ages to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think is really true of comedy. And I think that he wrote back, which I didn't expect, and he wrote back on the back of a postcard of a train, which I was amazed by, considering
how
my short little play was about people on a train. And he said, one of the tips he gave me was try and use different vocabularies for different characters. So really kind of embody those other people in your world and bring them to life. And I think that's true, that audiences like to see the richness of that world. Like, they don't want to hear it. It's really easy, I think, as a nervous person to go, oh no, no one wants to care about that. I'll just get on with just get the information across. And it's like, no, we have to, all the details and all the, you know, the words that a particular person would use are things that audiences love, because they're making that world come to 3D.
Yes.
It's not just somebody saying stuff. And I think that, I think that's, I don't know, maybe that was just a really long way of crowbarring in that Alan Bennett once wrote to me. But,
I
say he wrote to me. He wrote back to me.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. I think that what that makes me think is that you you on stage bring so much that it's, I keep coming back to the idea of richness, that when you're on stage, you are a very rich character with a lot of different levels and you know, that status thing we were talking about before. You have a very rich tool, which is your voice, which is sort of very broad as well. And you tell stories which have loads of detail, and people do have their own vocabularies and things like that. So I'm giving you 10 out of 10 as a comedian.
Oh, that's good.
I quickly became aware that didn't end in a question, but I do think that's what you do. You present, it's a real banquet of experience. Oh,
thank you. Well, thank you for saying that. And I think that I should remember that and do, try and always strive to do that more and better, if that's the sort of thing that you like, that people like. I think as well, people like David Sedaris, who I really like, is very good at.
You mentioned it before. I'm embarrassed to say I've not heard that name.
Oh really? Oh, everybody's talking about it. How embarrassing for me. He's an American short story writer who sort of made a thing of just not just but reading his stories out in front of audiences, and audiences, his fans go and love him. And I sort of tend to listen to his audio versions of his books as well, him reading them. And again, it's about that specific experience that he talks about his world, how he sees his world, and you know, being on drugs and working as a dwarf in Christmas time in Macy's, and sort of, I don't know what there's other peculiar things about, like things people have said to him and experiences he's had. It's so easy to go like, no, my experience isn't worthwhile. People don't want to hear about that. People don't want to hear about that thing I did. But they do. They do want to hear about that thing that you did. They don't actually want always to just go, oh yeah, I'm safe. That's like me. I'm the same.
Sure.
I think people, we owe it to people to take those risks and be specific.
Here is an odd kind of a paradox that I wonder sometimes if I'm trapped in, which is that I noticed that I really want to be liked. We've talked about this that kind of, I would say for me at least, compulsion. And that's part of what drove me into comedy initially. It's part of it. I also enjoy it, you know, but also I want to be liked, so I want to do comedy. I recognise within comedy that I can only go so far whilst wanting to be liked. So in order to get better at comedy, I need to not want to be liked. But the reason I want to be better at comedy is so that more people like me. Right? That's a kind of it's kind of a weird sort of thing that I am. What, speaking as someone who maybe came to it from that perspective, from a, you know, in an early kind of a way, do you see yourself as anywhere on that wheel now? Do you feel that you've changed?
I think that I didn't actually come to it wanting to be liked, strangely. I came to it feeling empowered by the people I'd seen as role models when I was growing up.
Gotcha.
And I came to it, and I think this is often the case when you start with something, I came to it going, well, I don't care if people don't like me. I know that. I sort of was very arrogant, I suppose, and went, well, this is my experience, and I think it's funny. So I'm going to talk about me, and the right people will like it, and if people don't get it, then that's not my problem. But then what happened was, I think, that people wanted to book me for things, and I realised that actually do have to be a bit. I did find myself feeling like I did have to try and please all the people all the time.
Okay.
Because I
am relieved, because I started thinking that, oh, I've got this all wrong. I feel embarrassed.
No. And I think that's. But then I think that is one of the things I found very frustrating and was a big part of my learning curve in the last few years since starting is that yes, there are times when you do want to please people, but actually you don't like. You don't need to like, and I found that very empowering in the last year to go, well, you know what, like, I don't mind if not everyone likes me, and I feel like I'm more secure in myself as a human being.
Yes,
okay. So that I can go like, I don't need to get all my validation from standing on stage.
Gotcha.
And that I go, well, I have a life, and I'm entitled to have a life with, you know, in any terms, regardless of how a room full of people in a.
Sure.
In a comedy club, think of and it. I don't always think that, but I aspire to that.
Yes. Are you pulling that off, do you think, more times than not? Are you happy?
More and more so. Again, it's one of those things I suppose I'm striving towards doing. Those are the things that I think are one of those like skills that I've realised I have to hone, of just going, yeah, it's okay not to do well all the time.
Mm.
And I think I'd rather be interesting than bland and loved all the time.
Sure. Loved by audiences?
Yeah.
Do you mean, yeah?
Yeah. I still want the love of my family.
Yes, friends. Well, yeah. Of course.
I'd say to them at Christmas, I don't care if you like me or not, I'm validated.
Tell me if this is too personal, and we need to talk about it, but you mentioned before that you've never had a relationship.
Yeah.
And you mentioned within this interview that a couple of times loneliness has come up.
Yes.
Is that... like I said, this might be sort of too... You know, we don't need to talk about this,
but I'm happy to talk about it.
In terms of your experience as an artist and what it brings to your work... Mm. Or the way your work affects it. I mean, something that can be for a lot of comedians. I think I've got to stop saying a lot of comedians. For me, you know, when you go out there and they all love you and it's great, and then you walk off and it's just you.
Yeah, right.
How does that feature in your challenges with loneliness?
I don't know. I think it's sometimes brings about a sadness in terms of. I feel like I'm probably being very self-indulgent here, but...
this is what I want you to be. That's why I'm asked.
Oh, fabulous.
That's why I want you on.
Oh, good. Well, in that case, settle in, folks. Strap in. I find that I am... that it can be really difficult, and I do sort of sometimes miss the idea of, that was a great show, but now I'm going to go back to my partner and carry on, you know, have that life. Which is actually my life, and that the stuff on stage is a lovely embellishment and is the thing I do for work, but actually my life is with this person and is doing the things that all human beings do, and I sometimes feel sad that I don't have that, and I pined for that for a long time, and was like, oh, I wish I had a boyfriend. If I had a boyfriend, it would be okay. But then in the last couple of years I just sort of kind of went, oh, bollocks to everything. I'll just kind of be like, oh well, I'll do whatever I want. If I want to go out and have dinner on my own, I can do that, and there's no there's no reason to feel self-conscious about that. And I've got friends. I'm lucky. I have great friends who I can hang out with, and just sort of get John Waters. I really respect. I just am throwing in all my inspirations.
Did he write to you?
He wrote to me a postcard of my face. And no, he said about how he's always been single. I read his book Role Models, and he said he's always been single.
Okay.
And that society has a real problem with it, actually. But he's like, he says he's very open about, like, I have sex with people, mm-hmm. and I like having sex with people, and I'm connected to people, but I don't want anybody to be part of my life. I don't want anybody to live with me. I've tried it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't suit me. And I think maybe there is, I don't know if I necessarily want to be single my whole life, but
sure.
I think it's interesting to kind of go, there are all kinds of ways of living your life, and that it doesn't always have to be like, you get married, you know, you of meet course. Somebody, a friend of a friend, you go out, you get engaged, get married, die. There's some other stuff in between. But, so I do sometimes feel like it is a difficult contrast of being, and as well, you're obviously standing up on your own and you're talking at people, so it's not always an interaction as a comedian, so that sure. can feel quite lonely. And then you travel home or you travel, you know, you've been traveling all day on your own. Mm-hmm. And that's hard, and that's why I think it's so important to surround yourself with positive things, as I think Destiny's Child once said, and you'll gain prosperity. But I do really want a boyfriend. But
suitors can tweet at Tom Indeed. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I feel like I wanted to say something interesting there, but I can't remember what it was. I can't remember.
Okay.
I'll put it on the stage.
Thank you. And the last thing really that I wanted to ask, because we've done an hour or so there, and I should let you get back to your life.
Crying, yes.
is that some of your stuff at the moment, you discuss gay marriage.
Oh, yes, that's what I was going to say about it, actually.
Okay.
And how I realised recently that the importance of something like gay marriage and the importance of marriage generally, or it's a rite of passage like that, is that it links you to the people around you. And I think that's sometimes the loneliness, I think, of one of the lonely feelings I think it's easy for a gay person to feel, maybe, is because if you're a straight couple, you're doing the thing your parents did. And then, you know, you maybe have children, and that's what obviously your parents did.
Yes.
So you're going through all these rites of passage, and it's very validating because you mirror them, which is something you do from the moment you're born. You start mirroring your parents, and it's very satisfying. It connects you to them strong. It makes this bond stronger.
Yes, okay.
And it makes the bond, you know, and you're repeating what people around you are doing in the pack, and it connects you to the people, you know, in for the history of mankind. You're repeating something that they've always done, forming kinship relationships, formalizing them, and having children. And I think that's something I wanted to say.
Yes,
I didn't really sort of wanted to say it on stage, but it's not very jokey.
Well, that's we could just talk about that briefly. About do you consciously make an effort to talk about issues on stage, or I mean, not sort of politics or issues even with a big I, but you mentioned gay marriage, and it's I mean, do you want to talk about issues on stage more, less than you already do?
Maybe more. I think, again, it's one of those things that it's easy to feel naive about and go, oh, I can't talk about that because I don't know enough about it. And there's a lot of intellectual snobbery, actually, I think, in all art forms, and comedy has it to an extent too.
Okay. What do you mean?
As in, like, it's easy to go, well, I can't talk about that because that's not my thing, like, I'm not intelligent enough to talk about that, I couldn't handle that subject.
Yes, okay.
But again, I think you can talk about it if you talk about your experience of it. So if you talk about your experience of the global economic crisis, which I was sort of doing some material about before I came out, of like, mm-hmm. what is it? Does anybody know what it actually
means? Sure.
Then you can. And I sort of, anything that's important to you, you should be allowed to talk about.
The thing that stops me, I suppose, is that I feel like I'm not informed enough. I have a hang-up about being ill-informed.
Exactly, that's exactly what I'm...
And so I think to myself then, what that makes me think is, oh, maybe I could do jokes about being ill-informed, but then I sort of think, I think probably a lot of comedians can easily do jokes about being ill-informed. And so then I get stuck in that mental sort of trap of going, well, I better inform myself. Oh, I haven't, I can't do this stuff.
But like talking about your actual cerebral understanding of something is interesting. Like, and
yes,
you can acknowledge... Okay. What is it, Aristotle? Was it Aristotle said he who knows most of all knows he knows nothing?
It may have been him.
Another.
It sounds
quote.
Aristotelian.
Another quote for people to embroider. I think kind of acknowledging, going like, well, I don't know everything about the global economic crisis, but nobody does.
Sure.
Like, the, you know, our political leaders don't. The head of the IMF doesn't. Probably, you know, doesn't understand it completely, because otherwise they'd just take care of it. Presumably, they'd sold it.
He's got a cracking 10 on his cock, though.
Yeah. So I think it's fine to talk about things, but it's, again, it's a bit like when, to talk about Eddie Izzard again, but when he talks about, like, the evolution, of, like, the history of the world or the ancient Greeks,
yes.
I'm sure he does know loads about it, but
yes.
He sort of talks about his understanding of that. And that's more fun, because we get, like, a child's... comedy is so much to do with being a child again and going... And undoing a lot of the things we get taught. Don't be silly, don't mess around, don't show off. It's undoing a lot of that and going, it's okay to play. We're often not allowed to play. And, you know, when kids play, it's like anything's possible. And, and a chair and a cushion becomes a spaceship, and a wall becomes a house, and a rock becomes a key, and, you know, and we, it's so easy to lose that and to go, oh no, that's rubbish, that's stupid, silly,
yes,
childishness.
Yes, I see.
Of course, a rock can never be a key. Why are you putting that into a wall, which is not a house, it's a wall? Because it's scary to use our imaginations, I think. And I think comedy can kind of make us go, oh no, I remember when everything was sort of magical and fun. And, oh, I just got married and, you know, that's all I did. And I think it's exciting that we can go, no, you can do whatever you want. I'm generalising about the people who get married, but you know what I mean.
Thank you.
Thanks,
man. So that was Tom Allen. I'm in bits. I love him. I just love him, and I miss him already. I think he is such a powerful presence on stage and such a fascinating comedian. Honestly, the stuff he was saying about the entitlement of artists to support is something that I don't think ever goes through my head, and it's so true. And I hope... I'm sure a lot of you would agree with that and maybe hadn't been thinking along those terms beforehand, as well as, of course, all his brilliant stuff and ideas. and advice about stand-up as well. So very, very pleased with that one. Thank you to Tom. Thank you to Dan Melrose for the music and Graham Crockford for his technical assistance. And that's all the stuff. So, yep, next week will either be... I think it'll be Felicity Ward. I'm 9/10 certain it'll be Felicity Ward. I've got one in the can, so I'm sure I can edit that up in time. And that's a corker of an interview as well. Thanks for listening. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. Remember to get your tickets 29th of May for Benny Boot. That was me stammering. He's not changed his name. Benny Boot on the 29th of May in London at the Crack Comedy Club. You can go on their website, crackcomedy.com, or you can go to comedianscomedian.com for the tickets. That's the lot. See you soon. Have you heard the podcast?
I've heard...
You don't? It's not a test.
No.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.